Did you ever get caught smack dab in the middle of a lie? Like you're spinning a yarn, you're coming up with all these details to make it sound legit, you know, to make it sound like it's believable. And then the other person that you're talking to just throws it out there that they know without a doubt that you're lying.
Can I plead the fifth on this one?
Yeah, you can. You can.
Sure. I mean, I think probably everyone has, right? If we're being honest, you've definitely been in, you know, even if it's just like a small little thing yeah. that you're fibbing about. Certainly as a kid. Yeah.
It's a funny situation though, right? Because there's not really a move there. I mean, obviously you can be honest, but it's not going to be accepted as okay, well, now you're telling the truth. That's okay. Because you were just caught. Right. So, mm-hmm. you know, you have options like you could double down. You could pretend like the other person is insane. There's a lot of different ways you can go, but none of them are a clear way to get out of that situation. Right.
Well, I think that depends. Right. So, like, I mean, if you double down, you're probably really just going to make things worse for yourself in the end. Right. Like you can, as you were saying, like you can like we see Marie do it, I think, at some points. Right. Like when she gets caught with like the whole thing about the tiara. I don't know what you're talking about. And then later when she like steals from the houses she goes to and they're doing the real estate and like remember the picture frame and she's still denying it.
Yeah, she denies it right to the bitter end as far as I remember, right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, she's like the evidence is on the floor in front of them, the smashed picture frame, and she's telling the real estate agent that she's gonna be in big trouble, you know? So it's it's yeah, but to your point, I think people react to that situation differently, depending on who they are. You can double down. You can try to gaslight the other person. No, you're crazy. You know, I would like to think that most of us, though, would own up to it or, you know, maybe depending on like the context of the lie. Right. Like, yeah, I don't know. A lot of it is contextual. It's situational.
Yeah. The only thing you can do is you can own up to it. It's kind of the last thing that you would want to do in that situation, because I think that when I think about Walt on the phone with Skyler there, I mean, he's just caught. He's just like a deer in headlights. You know, there's it's just blatantly he's lying and there's nothing that he can do to change that. And then, you know, when I think about that, I think about how a lot of times when we're lying to ourselves. And when you're doing that, you're already sure that you're lying, right? Mm-hmm. So you almost have to go on to this into this place to where you do it so much that it becomes your reality. And then it's kind of weird there because you just don't have that same path back anymore, because it's just you and the lie becomes real.
To your point, Pete, I think Walt becomes really, really good at deluding himself and lying to himself. And he, in terms of like effective lies and ineffective lies, the most effective lie that he is able to ever tell is the one he tells himself about like who he is and what's actually motivating him and what's driving him.
It was after school, trust me, I was there. Might have even helped bring you up. You and your extended warranty on the crib.
Ah. small world.
That it is.
The paths we take, huh?
Hello, this is Growth Decay Transformation, our Breaking Bad rewatch podcast. I'm Pete.
And I'm Courtney.
And we're joined by our producer, Talitha Barco. Today, we're here to talk about Season 1, Episode 3, and The Bags in the River. This was directed by Adam Bernstein, who also directed Episode 2, and he directed 8 episodes of the show total, which is a very significant amount. It's actually the second most for something to put that against Vince Gilligan, who created the series, only directed 5 episodes throughout the season. So he's got his hands all throughout the series. The title of the episode begins with an ellipsis. Is that that is what you call those three dots, right, Courtney?
Yes.
That's to indicate that it's connected to the previous title, and it completes the sentence, the cat's in the bag and the bag's in the river, which, you know, if the cat's out of the bag, that means there's some kind of information out there or a secret's been revealed, something to that effect. And so this quote comes from the 1957 film, The Sweet Smell of Success. And it would mean, at least in that context, it meant that a situation was there and it had been taken care of. You know, the cat was out of the bag, but it's now back in the bag, and now it's in, you know, it's in the river, and it's not going to be a problem anymore. Chronologically, in this episode, we get the earliest scene in the entire series when we see Walt talking to Gretchen in their college days. We saw on his plaque from when he did the research that was, you know, awarded the Nobel Prize. That was in 1985. So we know this is back sometime in the 80s before they went their separate ways. Courtney, would you like to summarize what happens in the rest of this terrific episode for us?
Yeah, sure. So this episode picks up where the previous one left off, with Walt and Jesse cleaning up the mess that is left behind after the hydrofluoric acid burns through the upstairs bathtub. Skyler grows concerned that maybe Walt's marijuana habit is changing his personality, and she broaches the subject with Marie, who then immediately concludes that it must be Walt Jr. who is smoking marijuana. Marie asks Hank to talk to Jr., who agrees to stop by after work. And we see that Jesse is starting to smoke more and more of the product, and after a confrontation with Walt, he flees the house, leaving Walt with the task of dealing with Crazy 8. Walt then creates a list of pros and cons of killing Crazy 8 versus letting him live. Meanwhile, Skylar has learned that Walt has been lying to her about working at the car wash, and she tells him not to come home. Crazy 8 yells for food, and when bringing him a sandwich, Walt has a coughing fit. He faints, and then he shatters the plate. When he finally comes to, he confesses to Crazy 8 that he has lung cancer, and the two have a friendly chat over beers. Right after Walt agrees to let him go, he discovers, dun-dun-dun, a shard of the broken plate is missing. A revelation that changes everything.
Why are you doing this to me?
Yeah. Or don't do this, or why are you doing
this?
So, Pete, what were your overall impressions of this one?
Well, I've been really excited to talk about this episode because this is the one where I really got hooked into the show, like was going to watch it until the end, no matter what. And we'll talk about that in a minute. But as far as overall impressions, what I really love about this episode is that the emotional core isn't that he commits murder, but it's watching what he goes through on his journey to become the person, or like to be in a place where he can do that. And they also provide some depth to Crazy 8's character, who was introduced basically as a garden variety drug world thug. And the whole process of Walter getting to know him is a great back and forth. And it sets the stage for them to do a lot more with the way that these characters interact going forward in the series, I think. What about you?
That conversation between Walt and Crazy 8 is one of the most important in the whole series, I think. When Walt essentially asks Crazy 8 to convince him of his humanity, and in turn, he puts the responsibility on Crazy 8 to save himself. And I think in this episode, we see the first big test when Walt is confronted with a moral dilemma, and we see the process of that interior struggle. So we've been talking a lot about process, and you just mentioned it yourself, where you're talking about this journey of how he gets to a particular place, right? So if I had to summarize my thoughts on this episode in a single sentence, it would be something is missing, which is a line from the episode. And there is the physical object that is missing, the shard of the broken plate, which of course is the revelation that forces Walt to commit murder. but something else is missing. So last week, when I asked you what was the most you ever lost in a coin toss, I was, you know, borrowing the question from Anton Chigurh of No Country for Old Men. And I mentioned that I think in that coin flip to decide who would kill Crazy Eight versus like who had to dispose of Emilio, what Waltz really lost in that moment was his soul. And at the end of this episode, the soul is the thing that Gretchen suggests is missing in the equation when they add up the individual components or elements of a human being. But, you know, I was thinking, I see another rhetorical connection in how Crazy Eight keeps telling Walt throughout this episode that he doesn't have it in him. And of course, what he means is that he doesn't have it in him to kill him. But he's proven wrong, and Walt will continue to prove many people wrong over the course of the series. And I was wondering, Pete, have you ever seen Interview with the Vampire, the original film?
I did, but it's not fresh in my mind.
Okay, so there's a scene that occurred to me when I was thinking about this episode. And it's right after Claudia has Louis, played by Brad Pitt, kill a woman so that she'll have like a companion, she'll have a friend. And as the woman is, like, he's turning her into a vampire. And as she is laying in the other room dying, Claudia comes out and she has this conversation with Louis. And he says what died in that room was not that woman. What died in that room was the last piece of him that was human. And I kind of think of that as what happens in a way with Walt when at the end he ends up killing Crazy Eight. It's kind of like maybe perhaps like that last shred of humanity in him. Not to say that we don't see human moments with Walt later. I think we definitely do. And I don't want to start, you know, saying like, oh, he has no soul, he's the devil or something like that. I don't think it's that black and white, but I think it is a pivotal turning point for this character where he crosses a line and he can't ever go back beyond that point. And so what we do learn he does have in him, and what this episode I think really reveals to us, is an incredible capacity for violence and deception.
Yeah, and it's smart the way that it all plays out here, because the writers actually make the choice to let him off the hook here. He doesn't have to get all the way there, because he discovers that Crazy Eight has a weapon, and he's going to, as soon as he lets him go, he's going to kill him. And, you know, that's the right way for him to think about it. I mean, that's a fair estimation of what's possible. And we see as it plays out that is exactly what he was planning on doing. I mean, he has his hand on it and he instantly goes to start stabbing at him when he realizes things are going the other way. So that's one of the things on rewatching at this time that got a little bit more crystal clear for me. I mean, it as things escalate, we see that he becomes the type of person who doesn't need that. He'll just do it because he feels like it's the right decision to make, and he's not as concerned with you know, his humanity of it all. I can't stop thinking about the left side of his pros and cons list, all the different things he put down there. Those things sort of just all become irrelevant as his, you know, as this series goes on. So.
Yeah. And it pales in comparison to the one reason why he should kill him, of course, is because he will kill you and your entire family. And that is a point that he keeps returning to. And I was thinking when I saw that to flash forward a little bit to in the scene in the lab when they're down there with Gus and with Gail Bettiker. And, you know, Walt explains to Gus, like, if you make it between me and Jesse, Gail loses every time, you know. So that's like what becomes like his ruling thought, right, is that he will always do what he has to do to protect himself. And certainly at that point, he has no qualms anymore. I think we still see him struggle a little bit in this episode. And we see that moment after he actually kills Crazy Eight, how he drops to his knees and he's apologizing over and over and over again. And I don't know. I mean, I guess when we get to that episode, when we start talking about Gail and what happens to Gail, and did Walt really have any remorse or feelings about that? I don't know. But certainly we see that at this point, he's still struggling a little bit with that, and or at least debating the decisions. And so you mentioned decisions, and that's something else that really stood out to me in this episode, on making decisions and all the different choices and questions of choice and questions of like agency and what is actually directing and moving Walt.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's something that he, at this point, I still feels like he isn't making any of those, like any of his own decisions. And this is something we'll see in, not the next episode, but the one after it. I think it's in Grey Matter when they have that little family intervention with the talking pillow, when he explains that he doesn't feel like he makes any of his own choices. But of course, he is making his choices. Like even in the last episode, when they decide to do the coin flip to divvy up the roles of who's going to do what, by not making a choice, right, like leaving it up to the coin, he is still, that's still a decision. He's making a decision not to make a decision.
Don't forget your pants. We'll be back after this short break.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of Apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints, except it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was, and those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim, order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar, then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live. Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
We've got lots of ongoing coverage this week, from book versus show comparisons for Hot D to the latest very special episode of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? But there are a couple of main events this week you need to know about.
Firstly, we've got a brand new commission podcast out this Tuesday covering the Raid 2, sometimes subtitled Retaliation. If you're a fan of martial arts films, this is one you don't want to miss. Iko Uwais is a rising star in the action movie world, and it's easy to see why. Join us on Tuesday as we dive into the bigger, badder sequel to The Raid, try and figure out which is better.
Then on Thursday, we're covering the season finale of Hulu's excellent period drama, Shogun. We've been waiting all season to see what Toranaga Sama's plan is, or if he even has one. It all comes down to this, and we couldn't be more excited. Join us on Thursday for what's sure to be an epic Shogun season finale podcast, and to find out if we plan to cover any related materials.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
Fire up the RV. We're back with more Growth, Decay, Transformation.
Yeah, it's a lot about perspective and the way he sees... the way he chooses to see his situation. You know, like we talked a lot about the way they set him up and about how he's passive. If you become a passive participant in life, I mean, there is a decision there, right? I mean, it mm-hmm. may happen. It may not be something that you sit up and decide, okay, I'm going to be this way. But if you're not actively trying to change that, and then you're just reacting to things as if they're happening to you and you have no way to you know, regain control or whatever your own personal narrative is, the way that you think about yourself, then that there is a decision there. It's a decision not to act. And this episode puts him into a situation where he can't, it goes on for quite a long time, but there's just no ending to this scenario where he doesn't have to act one way or the other. And so, of course, a person like him, and when we see that and we start to understand that even better, of course, he's going to look outward and try to figure out why this is someone else's fault and not his. And we talked about it a little bit in the last episode. You start to see that coming out, and he does that again here with the, I mean, we don't get a whole lot of Jesse in this episode, but it's kind of there's kind of a great exchange there where he shouts at him, you know, like, it's because you didn't follow my instructions.
Mm-hmm.
And, if you think back to the original back and forth that they had, he didn't really assert why it was important or drive the idea home. He just expected Jesse to listen to what he said, you know, because he was in the position of authority between those two. And that was a pretty big mistake, it turned out. And we see them dealing with that at the opening of this episode. So, it's really character wise. It's really starting to put a lot of stuff there to make you think about, you know, who this guy is and what is he capable of.
Yeah, so I it's interesting what you were just saying about like how like he has this idea of like how things are going to go, and he is in this sort of teacher student role with Jesse, you know, mentor mentee also in a way. Like he wants him to follow his directions explicitly, and then when he doesn't, of course, we see what happens. So it's this. With Walt, I think it's interesting how like he is okay giving direction, right? He's okay sort of delegating what Jesse should do. But when it comes to making those own choices and decisions, he really struggles. And so you already mentioned like making the pros and cons list and things like that, like trying to think rationally or reason his way through to that decision. And I really think this whole episode is really couched in choices. And I just rewatched it again before coming to record this episode. And at the very beginning of the episode, right after they start cleaning up stuff, and we see Walt down in the basement and he's cleaning out Crazy 8's bucket, like he flushes his waste into the toilet, and Crazy's like, turn around, you look at me, look at me. And then they have this exchange where, he tells him, like, you know, basically to let him go. And he says, I don't see what choice you really have. This is Crazy 8 talking. He says, it's between that, meaning let me go, or cold-blooded murder. And that's when he first says, you know, he doesn't have it in him. So Crazy 8 presents that dilemma to him. I don't see what choice you really have. Like, the choice is a given. The choice is that you will let me live because you don't have this thing within you.
Because you're not a killer.
To do this. Yeah, exactly. And it becomes a challenge, I think, for Walt in a way. You know, and then at the end, though, too, when Walt, after they have this conversation right before he kills him, they're having this like heart to heart and they're, you know, talking about their lives and stuff like that. Walt starts crying, like actual real tears. And he says,
yeah,
I don't know what to do. And Crazy 8 says, yeah, you do. So he's making the decision for him. And then Walt's like, I'll get the key. And then, of course, he goes upstairs. He finds the plate is missing the shard. And we already talked a little bit about this, but I think it's a point that we really need to hammer home, right? Is that when he discovers that missing shard, it's not like, oh, well, now I have to do this. Or it's not really crystallizing in like his mind that it's his choice.
You're making me do this. Yes. Why are you making me do this?
Exactly. It's still some sort of external force acting on him, you know, as opposed to him making the decision himself.
Agreed. All right. Before we keep going in that direction, as I mentioned at the beginning, this is the moment where I realized that I was a super engaged, totally into it Breaking Bad fan, was watching this episode. And I've been waiting to tell this story and talk about it, and we finally made it. So I can remember the reason. One of the reasons I wanted to talk about this is because I watched this series so long ago that it's kind of hard to remember sometimes whenever I'm thinking about how it hit the first time I watched it. Also kind of binged through the beginning of it, you know, so there's a lot of it that just sort of blurs together, but there's one memory I do have that's crystal clear. And it is, first of all, did you tell us when you fell in love with the series? You're a pilot person?
Yeah, I was pretty much hooked from the pilot. I think I was one. I think we did talk a little bit about this in our introductory episode.
Yeah,
talking about how we came to the series. So I was I came to it kind of late through Netflix and got caught up that way. But yeah, it was the first episode I was hooked.
Yeah, and I was super intrigued by the pilot. Like I loved it. I thought it was great. But I didn't really know what to make of it. I didn't know what to expect out of this character. Like, I still thought there was a pretty good chance it could be a comedy, just based on the premise. You know what I mean? Like, it didn't have a lot of comedic leaning in that pilot. There was some funny stuff, but it wasn't. But I mean, I just didn't really know what to expect because I wasn't used to stories like this. And there were moments in the second episode too, like when the bathtub crashes through the floor and things like that. But I do remember very distinctly when I was watching this episode, when he comes downstairs and he passes out, he faints because he has the coughing fit. And then he wakes up and he tells Crazy Eight that he just lets it out that he has lung cancer. And and I remember thinking to myself, I was like, he hasn't told anyone else. Like it just hit me, you know, like that I had been watching this character, I've been paying attention, and he had this diagnosis in the pilot, but all of that's happened since then, I've been so wrapped up in it, I just realized he hasn't told anyone else. This is the first person he's told. He's been carrying this thing around with him. And, you know, I just thought, oh, well, that's interesting. Like I'm really following this character. I'm really into this. Right. And then later in the episode, he doesn't say anything else there. And I wasn't 100% sure, you know, I just thought it felt like it was the first person he was telling. And then later, Crazy Eight asks him in their conversation, he says, does Jesse know? And he says, no. And he says, you know, his family doesn't know. Nobody knows. He's the only person that knows about it. And it just validated me paying attention. You know what I mean? Like it felt like there was an exchange going on between me and the people who were creating the show. Like they were going to anticipate how I was going to be watching and how I'd be reacting and where I would be at. And they were smart enough to, you know, go there with me. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, it does. And I'm like you, I found that really surprising that this is the first person he says anything to, right? Like he doesn't tell his own family. He doesn't tell Jesse, but he tells this guy that he has chained up in the basement. Right. Mm-hmm. And, one of the major like themes of this episode that stood out to me is this question of humanity and what makes us human. So there's both like the actual physical construction of humans, like what boiled down to like our most like fundamental parts, our molecules, yeah, like being made of oxygen, hydrogen, you know, down to the trace minerals sorts of thing. And so we have that flashback with Gretchen and how humans are made and what makes a human. Then we also get to see like the deconstruction of a body. And as he's like picking up parts and cleaning up the mess left behind by Emilio, picks up the jawbone and stuff like that, of course, as he's remembering this conversation, but also what makes us human and like vis-a-vis each other, like how do we relate to each other? And I already mentioned that scene where Walt is downstairs talking to Crazy Eight. And at first he's like not talking to him at all. He's ignoring him. He's just cleaning stuff up.
Yeah. He says, look at me.
Look at me
when he's down there.
And I
don't mean to derail you there, but I just wanted to point out too that, like I mentioned earlier, the way they use him here as a person who's literally chained to a pole in the basement, and he sees the, you know, in the beginning, he sees the blood coming down through the floor, dripping on there. Like that's what he's doing with his time, right? He's sitting there mm-hmm. watching and just wondering what horrors await him. And, I really like the decision to make him kind of rational in the way that he approaches this. And he comes up with a pretty good plan when you think about it, right? Like he says, I can see this guy for who he is. I mean, he did get a little bit of information from Jesse, he goes straight to like trying to, put a wedge between those two, you know what I mean? And it just plays into this whole idea of like, okay, what's the worst thing that could happen if you tell a lie? You know, like what could really happen? Well, you might have to kill someone, you know, and that person might actually be a worthy adversary, for lack of a better term. Like he might be someone that will make you make that not any easier than it already is, you know?
Yeah. And what I was going to say, I think what you're touching up against again is this question of choice, right? So mm-hmm. Crazy Eight has to make choices about how best to relate to this man who's keeping him hostage. And yeah. So what I was saying at the beginning, right? Like he demands that Walt acknowledge him and acknowledge his yeah. humanity. And he says the line is that this is degrading, right? And so he's letting Walt know that you're dehumanizing me, right? Like this is inhuman. I wouldn't do this to my worst enemy. And Walt just sort of sheepishly says sorry, and then he scurries up the stairs again. Like he's not ready to face that. And this idea that of how like Crazy Eight keeps reinforcing this idea, you don't have this in you, this doesn't suit you, this line of work doesn't suit you. It's something that he keeps drilling into Walt again and again and again, like trying to convince him, right? And so it's a tactic, right, to persuade him and get him to reason like this is, you know, a terrible choice. And he even says, you have a choice, either you let me go or you murder me. It's cold-blooded murder. That's not who you are. And I think in this episode, we very much do learn that is who Walt is. And Walt comes to learn that this is also who he is. And I think it's all the more telling that he comes to this realization after actually having this very human moment with Crazy Eight. So that conversation when they're sitting there and drinking beer and getting to know each other, and Crazy Eight even says to Walt, like, you know, getting to know me isn't going to make this any easier. And
yeah, I love that line. I love the way he pulls that out in, it's funny in a way because he's doing the exact thing that he's telling Walt that he shouldn't do, you know, because he says, not that I mind it, you know, like he's kind of tipping his hat at the same time, isn't he?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it's interesting though, because we see like what Crazy Eight is capable of, right? So he also learns yeah. that this man is dying of cancer, and Walt really sort of, you know, lays bare his soul to him. You know, he's confessing to him things he hasn't told anyone. He cries right. in front of him, you know, like he really makes himself very vulnerable in front of Crazy Eight. But Crazy Eight's going to kill him, you know, first opportunity he gets. He has that shard and he has it ready. And one of the things I think that is the real genius of this episode, and certainly one of the things that I think makes it one of the more powerful episodes in the first season, is how it shows us how these characters are grappling with these choices and these decisions. But also it puts the viewer in that position as well. What would you do in that
yeah,
position?
Absolutely.
Yeah, so you're able to, at least I was able to, both empathize a lot with Crazy Eight, right? Like, who wouldn't say the things that he's saying? Who wouldn't do what he's trying to do to survive, you know?
Yeah.
You know, it's strategic, but also you see him as this human being chained up like an animal. But at the same time, you're also able to, of course, empathize with Walt's point of view, where, you know, if I let this guy go, he's going to come back and kill my whole family. So it's an interesting
episode. I mean, that
episode
is the reality of the situation too. I mean, just to like, there is no way that there's no way that he can get him to, that he can let him go, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like he has to, Crazy Eight will respond. He killed his cousin. He kept him locked up. I mean, there's no ending to this where they have a conversation and Crazy Eight says, yeah, you know, it's not a big deal. I'll let it slide.
Yeah. I mean, he was going to kill him, you know, the day they met.
Like, we see him do that, but I'm just saying, like, even if we hadn't seen that at the end, like, you know, just going through it, like Walt's pros and cons list is actually is pretty on the nose there. Like, he'll kill your entire family if you let him go on the side of kill him. That's the reality, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's just, I just wanted to make sure that we were on the same page of that, because of course Walt wants to believe, hoping against, you know, anything else, that he could possibly find a way to coexist with this guy after everything that's happened.
No, of course not. And I mean, you could watch this episode, you can be like, Walt really didn't have a choice. And yeah, the way that even Crazy Eight lays it out to him, it's either you let me go or it's cold-blooded murder. But there is another choice, right? It's not a choice that Walt would want, or probably even Crazy Eight would want. And that choice is you go to the police, right? And that's, of yeah, course, that's a choice that they're not going to consider. So, yeah, but to say that it was just between, it's a false binary, right? Like, it's either or.
I guess so, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there's points of no return in any kind of criminal enterprise, I guess, you know, like whenever, I think if we look at this one, it's like, if you kill someone's cousin, mm-hmm, and then you chain them to a pole in the basement, there's no way that you can avoid that coming back up at a different time, right?
Yeah, and I think what you just said there are points of no return. That's really where we are at the end of this episode. There is a line crossed, right? So he kills Crazy Eight, and then there's an exchange right before he actually, you know, chokes him to death with a bike lock as he's spinning around the pole, and Walt's like, you know, so we're good, you know, you're not angry or whatever the line is, and Crazy Eight says, whatever, man, I just want to go home. And Walt says, me too. And I thought that was a really, really poignant line, right? For a couple of reasons, because earlier in the episode, Skyler has figured out that he's been lying to him. He quit the car wash and she tells him not to come home, stay wherever you are. So he can't actually go home in terms of like going home that night, right? So like he has this other now problem that he has to contend with, that he has to deal with, but also he can't go back. You can't revert, right? Like he is now becoming a cold-blooded murderer. So he, of course, he already killed Emilio, but that was self-defense. You could argue this is intentional. Crazy Eight is chained to a pole, right? That is a very, very premeditated. And I think that's the distinction. This is a premeditated, pre-planned murder.
Yeah, that's the thing that I was kind of getting at there a minute ago, was that they do let him off the hook in the sense that they set up that the actual killing as a me or you situation, right? Because he has the blade, he was certainly going to stab him as soon as the bike lock came off. Like we see that it's you know, he goes out stabbing. So yeah, but I mean, the point of why I was bringing that up was that even though that's true, it was still a situation where there's no way that both of these people walk out of there, you know, and say, hey, we're gonna just pretend like that didn't happen.
Yeah, no way.
Yeah. So like on the one hand, the writers let him off the hook and make it so that he doesn't have to choose in the last minute. But that's kind of interesting if you think about how, as we said, he's blaming it on him for taking the thing. So that gives him a little bit of cover inside of his own, like, you know, looking at it morally or whatever. And then you also have the, you know, it's a literal, it's a him or me kind of situation when it actually goes down.
Yeah, that's such a good point. So, I mean, and I was sort of alluding to this earlier. He really puts the responsibility on Crazy Eight, right? So, like, he tells Crazy Eight, sell me, right? Like, he, when he's, yeah. when they're first starting to talk, it's like, it's his responsibility to persuade him not to kill him, right? Like, you have to convince me not to do it. So it's his responsibility. And if he fails, then he's going to die. But still, even at the end, you know, it's like, it's his fault for taking the shard. This is, again, I'm speaking in terms of Walt's point of view. It really, to your point, lets him off the hook in his own mind, right? Like, he's not taking responsibility for this. He was left with no choice. He had to do this. And I think that's what's really driven home at the end there. And just something else I wanted to mention that you got me thinking of, Pete, when you were talking about when you first brought up the idea of how, like, Crazy 8's the first person he tells. He doesn't tell anyone else that he has cancer. And at the very end of this episode, when he walks into the bedroom, when he's back at the house and you see Skylar sitting on the bed, he tells her, you know, I have something I need to tell you. And this, again, it's like a kind of like a get out of, you know, it's getting off the hook again. He's using information to explain the behavior. He, of course, needs to tell her that he has cancer, but he, as he even tells Crazy 8, and I actually believe that he is honest in that conversation with Crazy 8, that it's not a conversation he's even remotely ready to have. And it's not a conversation he wants to have. He's only doing it as a cover, right? Like, this is why I've been acting weird. And of course, as soon as he tells, it's manipulative. In other words, he's using that information, I have cancer, to excuse and explain his behavior over the past couple of days or whatever. So again, it's not like he's telling her because he wants to. It's withholding and using information for his own purposes.
Undoubtedly. Let me ask you this. Do you think Walt would have painted the nursery?
If he wasn't busy cooking meth and, you know, doing his side business, I think so.
Yeah, it's one of the things that stood out to me on this rewatch this time, because, you know, they're talking about it earlier. They say, hey, I want, what are you going to do this weekend? And he said he wants to go up to Los Alamos or whatever to see the rover, the Mars rover photographs, because he heard they were really great. But, you know, he says, I will paint. And I think that probably he would, right? Like, before he started cooking meth, I mean, he had a second job, he was busy, but he was the kind of guy probably that would take care of that for his wife, right?
I think so. And certainly, I mean, we do see him, like, he's very handy, like when he's fixing the water heater and then he discovers there's that dry rot and, you know, goes through all that trouble. I think he definitely would. I mean, he seems like the type that is a fixer.
Yeah. And I think, like, you know, because Marie brings it up here, she said you could just have Walt do it. And I just think that's another red flag, right? Like, for all of this going on with Skylar and not understanding what's going on with her husband, and, you know, that's sort of on the sideline at this point. But, like, I think that probably stands out to her, right? That she asked him to do this, that she's pregnant, she's up on the ladder. It might be dangerous for her at that stage in her pregnancy. And there she is. She's there doing it while he's somewhere else and not really doing a great job of covering up the fact that he's doing something strange.
Yeah, that is a good point. But I think it also tells us something about Skylar's character as well, right? So Skylar is someone that is not going to necessarily wait idly by for other people to take action. She is very much a doer as well. So she asked him to do it. So do you suppose, I don't know if we're ever, like, is it, do you have a sense that this is the weekend, like the weekend following the events of the previous episode? Because, like, they were talking about Saturday, right? Like, what are you doing on Saturday? So I was wondering, like, because it seems like Marie stopped by after work, right? So she's working and I always imagined it was like a weekday and Skylar is impatient waiting. So it's before the weekend and she decides to start painting.
Well, Walt Jr.'s there, so it's not during school hours. You had a sense that this was all happening in a short period of time, but when she says she talked to Bogdan, she says that he quit work 2 weeks ago, so that we know it's been a bit of time that's passed.
Yeah, that's a good point. So, yeah, I mean, this could be the weekend. It could be even further into the future than the weekend. I don't know. I get the sense, though, that the events of cleaning up the remains of Emilio happen immediately after the events of the previous episode, right? Like, they're not going to just leave it there.
That did happen pretty quickly. I guess, like, the cook is, I guess there was some time maybe in between when they actually got together to cook is how that works out.
Yeah. So, I mean,
or it's just like we have to accept it because it's TV and we have, yeah. You know, TV time is different than real time kind of thing.
Yeah. But all that, I mean, timeline aside, right? That I don't think is terribly important to your point. What's important, yeah. though, is that she asked him to do something and he hasn't done it. So she's doing it herself. Yeah. So I think that does tell us something about their relationship, but whether he would have done it or not. I mean, because we spent some time in that first, when we were talking about the pilot, about the kind of relationship that they have and how Skylar wears the pants in the family. She seems to be the one that does things, gets things done, and Walt will do things when asked to do them sort of thing.
I think it might be a red flag that she's up there on that ladder, like that she has to be wondering, why would he let me do this? Because this is not the Walt that I know or whatever. And then speaking of being like out of commission and kind of going somewhere and being somewhere, this is kind of an interesting Jesse episode too. I mean, there's not a lot of him at the house because he bugs out, he takes off. And I did want to talk a little bit about this confrontation they have in the bathroom.
Mm-hmm.
Walt gets really upset, and I mean for good reason here too, because he just sort of told Crazy Eight and Emilio at the time like a lot of personal information, including stuff about Walt Jr., which is, it's very, you know, like that's definitely not something you want to do, or that's not information you want to have out there when you're starting up a meth business, right?
Yeah, it's a total betrayal of trust, right? You know, you work with someone, you expect them to hold confidences, and to find out that you know so much about him and his family, of course he's upset. You know, the point that Crazy Eight makes, that your real problem is sitting upstairs, I think is one that proves true and something that we see over and over and over and over again.
So, yeah, there's a lot to that. I mean, it does, what he says does sort of prove true later, that his problem is Jesse in some ways. It's not the only one he has, obviously. But it leads to this great confrontation, which I want to talk a little bit because it's hilarious and it does... It does pair well with an episode that ends in murder, right? You know, give us a little bit of breathing room, a little bit of something fun to watch, and it's really physical. You know, like these guys, the two actors really get into it in this bathroom over this bag of crystal meth.
Yeah, it is. There is a lot of comedy in that scene, and Jesse has some great lines when they're downstairs, out front, yeah. And he's getting ready to leave. You know, the coin flip is sacred.
Sacred, so yeah,
there's a lot of comedy in that, and even though Jesse doesn't really play a big role, he doesn't have a lot of screen time in this episode. I think what we are shown is important, right? So we do get that comedy, that moment of levity, to your point, Pete, that is so important in an otherwise pretty bleak, dark episode. But also we see that Jesse's not immune to what's going on. So we see the
pressure. He does have to live there. He says that, you know, like, yeah. He has to live in that house. Like, he owns it.
Yeah, it smells like a toe cheese and dry cleaning.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's pretty awful when you think
about
it. But
what I was going to say, though, is we do see him start to use more meth, right? And we saw it in the previous episode as well. Like, he, every time anything, like significant happened to him, like, you know, like trying to get his nerve up to go and get the body out, he smokes a bowl. After the confrontation with Skylar, when she shows up in his driveway, he smokes a bowl. And we see him now, after having cleaned up this horrific mess, he's upstairs getting high. So we can see that this is someone that does not cope well with this kind of pressure. And I think it's, you know, obviously it's foreshadowing and letting us know, like, what, in a sense of what's to come, right? Like, how does Jesse cope with pressure? He doesn't, or stress, right? So this is, of course, going to become more important.
Yeah,
it's going to become more and more important as the series progresses and they get deeper and deeper into it, and more horrible things happen, and how he responds to those kinds of stressors. So, yeah, I think it is important what we do see of him and how he physically flees the scene, right? Like, he, as you said, can't cope. He runs away.
Yeah. And we get a little bit of an introduction to the Marie as a shoplifter storyline. maybe
yes, we
not,
do.
Maybe not a lot of people's favorite side story, but you know, we'll get to that when we talk about it. But we are starting to see more of the other characters in Walt's world, and I think it's kind of interesting the way that they show Marie here. She likes to, we get an idea that she likes to insert herself in what's going on in other people's lives, right? She gets this sense, because Skylar brings up the idea of smoking pot, that it must be Walt Jr. because he's at that age. There's no other real reason to believe that, but she just runs with it and calls Hank and gets him involved. So we see that, you know, that she has this tendency to want to kind of insert herself maybe where she doesn't, you know, where she's not needed maybe, right?
Yeah, yeah. She's a gossip, right? And yeah. She's into like what we call chisme, right? Like she's into everyone else's business and knowing things. But you know, it's funny you bring up the shoplifting scene, because one of the great ironies of that scene to me, right, is that she's calling Hank and, you know, she's, you know, telling him that Walter Jr. is smoking pot and you got to do something about it. So she's moralizing, right? And the way she also reacts to Skylar when Skylar asks her the question, how horrified, well, we got to stop it. You know, is it this Lewis guy? La, la, la. You know, she's all upset about it. And just the sort of the total cognitive dissonance of her, you know, judging other people and, you know, thinking in terms of like how horrible this is that you know Walter Jr. is maybe smoking marijuana. Meanwhile, she's stealing, right? She's shoplifting. So that split, I think, is really telling about the character. And
and it's even more than that, because she's the way that I read this scene is that this is the first time that she's really done it, maybe, or she's not it's not a normal thing for her yet. But she justifies it by the fact that the girl in the front isn't paying attention to her. Isn't,
yeah.
You know, she asked her to put on the footies. Oh, my God. You know, so like, you know, you see that she's kind of like Walt in that way, too. Right. It's somebody else is making her do this. So there's a little there's a nice little parallel there.
Yeah. And I think that this is a problem that's existed for some time, because when Skylar almost gets arrested, as she says, after the confrontation in, was it called Zachary's, the little store where the tiara came from when she goes to return it after the baby shower.
Yeah.
And she tells Hank later, Skylar does, about it, and he's aware of it and that she's been working with someone. I don't think this is the first instance. I think something else must have happened previously. Maybe there was like a moment where she like got in trouble. I don't know if she ever actually got arrested. I think probably
that's
Hank
right.
was able
You're
to
right.
interfere.
I forgot about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think it's a problem that has existed previously. But again, this is like Marie's later on anyway, like how she copes with stress. What does she do? She goes and pretends to be other people. She goes into look at open houses. Things like that, and shoplifts more, I guess, or not shoplifts, but steals, right? So she's something more of like a kleptomaniac, I guess, is more of her issue. So yeah, I think it is an important thread, right? For not just her character, but one of the things that this show does is it shows us that everyone is imperfect. Everyone has they have like, there's a duality to all of the characters. They have the image that they present, you know, to some people, and then also like this hidden inner self that you know is revealed. So we see it with Hank, right? So we see this the macho, you know, in charge, confident cop, and then we also see what happens when
Sit
he's
down.
Dealing with that's a good impersonation. Siéntate. So we see, and then we see what happens to him as he starts to fall apart, deals with PTSD, and of course, Walt, of course, but also Jesse, we see how he copes, and Skylar. So I think it's important that we see that part of Marie, even if it's not a fan favorite. It is an important part. And you said something that's kind of almost like Walt. I think there are a lot of parallels between Marie and Walt. And how they
her seems a lot lower stakes, but they're following the same thought pattern. You know, they're doing they're reacting to what they consider to be, you know, an untenable situation in their own ways. It's just kind of cool that it makes you think about how Waltz is an extreme case of escalation, but you know, it's not that hard to imagine it happening to other people as well.
Yeah, stealing a spoon is a far cry from murder, so I'm not going to compare the behavior.
If it broke a different way, she might have been killing someone to cover up that spoon too, maybe. I don't know.
Maybe. I know that was actually one thing that they talked about as like a possible ending, and is like Marie kills Waltz, you know? I don't know how serious that was, but I don't know.
Yeah, that would have been something, huh?
Yeah, it would have been quite a different ending. Maybe that's the ending that Vince Gilligan originally wrote before the script got stolen out of Bryan Cranston's car.
Yeah, that's definitely something that would be a much different. It would have a much different tone, I guess, would be the way to think about that, huh? One of the things that popped out to me here, you know, in again, on looking at it as a rewatch, now that Better Call Saul is complete, and they say that a couple of times in the last two episodes about Crazy Eight, his name, where did that come from, what does it mean? So I thought that was interesting that they went back and they answered that question in what, season 5, episode 2 of Better Call Saul.
Mm-hmm. The card game with Lalo.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it made me think of Lalo a little bit there.
And it also they also explained how Crazy Eight came to be a snitch in Better Call Saul. So that's something else that they did in the episode where he gets busted and the cartel sends Jimmy in as his lawyer.
Right, and that is another aspect here. You know, when the Hank's last scene when they go back out to the desert and they find his car, they find the meth after he discovers the hidden compartment.
Yeah, the trap.
And he says it looks like meth, but it's too damn white, which is a pretty cool line. But they say they figured it out that somebody croaked their snitch and. That's kind of, I don't know. I mean, like it definitely stands out after watching Better Call Saul, and they talk about this more coming up in the series, but it kind of recontextualizes all of what was happening way back to the pilot too, doesn't it? Because it's showing that whenever he was confronting Jesse at his place, whenever Emilio just got made bail or whatever, he's covering up for himself, right? He was the snitch. He knew it, obviously. And he was trying to put, the same way that he tried to put, doubt on Jesse's character with Walt, he's trying to do that with Emilio in his house by saying, you know, it's kind of funny that you just happened to be next door with the neighbor whenever they got there and all that.
Yeah. I mean, but Crazy Eight's the snitch, not Emilio, right?
Yeah, I mean, I'm saying, but he was trying to make Emilio think that Jesse was, you know, he's trying to cover it up.
Yeah, yeah, okay, yeah. Yeah, gotcha. Yeah, definitely. It does recontextualize it. You're listening to Growth, Decay, Transformation. We'll be right back.
We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R. R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts. FX is adapting James Clavell's best-selling novel, Shogun, into a 10-part miniseries this spring. Set in the shogunate period of Japan at the turn of the 15th century, Shogun depicts the rise of a feudal lord to Shogun, as seen through the eyes of a shipwrecked English sailor. It's loosely based on the real-life exploits of William Adams and Tokugawa Ieyasu.
Shogun has already been successfully adapted back in 1980 with a widely acclaimed miniseries starring Richard Chamberlain, featuring intricate plots, political scheming, complex characters, and thrilling action. This time, husband and wife team Justin Marks and Rachel Kondo try to recapture the successes of the novel and early adaptations while increasing the levels of historical and cultural accuracy that are often perceived as flaws of this and similar works.
Starring Hiroyuki Sanada from The Last Samurai, Mortal Kombat, and John Wick 4, with Cosmo Jarvis of Peaky Blinders, Raised by Wolves, etc., joining the truly massive cast required to bring this complex world to life. Join Aaron and I each week as we deep dive into each episode, uncovering the mysteries, the intrigue, and the glory of Shogun.
Shogun premieres on FX Hulu Tuesday, February 27th, with a two-part debut. Our podcast will release each Thursday thereafter. Get our Shogun coverage by searching for Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if very special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd.
Let's get cooking. We're back with more Growth Decay Transformation. Speaking of how watching Better Call Saul has recontextualized Breaking Bad, something that stood out to me watching this episode was some of like the very similar lines that we get throughout this this episode to Better Call Saul. So something that we've already talked a little bit about is how Crazy 8 keeps saying to Walt that this line of work, you know, like, this isn't you. This is you don't have it in you, Walt. And yeah. That's something that I was reminded of in Better Call Saul when Suzanne Erickson, who's the assistant district attorney, is talking to Kim Wexler, and she's trying to figure out like if Jimmy has been working for the cartel, and she says it's not a suit that fits him, right? And so that stood out to me here.
Mm.
So
yeah, we're going to talk about our favorite lines and things coming up here, and I think we're going to hit on some of this stuff. So what do you think? Like, do you want to go right into that right now?
Yeah, I was thinking you could, right? Because I was thinking you could say, you know, it's funny you bring that up because my favorite line is.
All right. It's funny that you bring that up because my favorite line of this episode, you know, we do our favorite line and favorite shot at the end of each episode. And my favorite one here is this line of work doesn't suit you, Walter. It's one of those things, like, whenever I think about it, It's a perfectly crafted line, right? This isn't somebody saying something off the cuff. This is somebody who's been sitting in the basement thinking a lot. That's really kind of what I like about this. And it's also, you know, I mean, obviously it's apparent that Walter is not a, you know, he's not the kind of guy that you usually run into in the drug world, you know, but like, I think it just shows, like, whenever the way that it's delivered, the way that he's doing this, this character is doing this, it really makes him a lot more compelling, a lot more interesting because of the way that it comes off, like you can just tell this is something that he's been sitting there thinking about, like, how can he get through to him? And this is just it. Like, just put out the exact most obvious thing, the truth, you know, this is not who you are, basically.
Yeah. And it is a great line. I love this line too. Cause again, it's like Walt trying to prove that, you know, nobody else is going to define him anymore at this point. So yeah. You're saying it's not a line of work that suits me, that I don't have it in me, but you know, he's going to prove to everyone that he actually does. It's a great line. And I think really reveals a lot about that character.
And then my shot in this one would be Walt cleaning up, like we see him through the floor, and it's that thing that this show does a lot. And I don't think we talked about it too much yet, but it's like flipping the point of view from the character to this inanimate object, to the house, basically. Like the house becomes a character. It's a place where this thing happens, right? And it kind of gives you a sense that the whole situation is then out of their hands. You know, if you think about a standard point of view shot, a POV shot where you see, where as a viewer, you see exactly what the character's seeing, that kind of puts you in their place, right? It connects you with what they're experiencing, and that can like heighten your whole sense of what it's like to be them in that moment. So when you turn that around, there's a disconnect, right? So it's great how that lines up with the inevitable ending of this situation, like how he has to end up killing him without making the decision. It just sort of goes through, like it's going to happen anyways. Do you understand what I'm saying there?
Yeah. I definitely do. And it is a great shot. So you're speaking of like the opening shot to the episode as he's wiping away the blood. And then, so we're looking up at him from like under, obviously like a plate of glass. And you see him, wipe it. Yeah, that is great. And you mentioned a couple things I want to respond to. So one of the things I think that both series, both Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul, do really, really well are that object point of view. They do some really interesting things, like putting the camera on like doors that are shutting. And so you get a lot of really cool, innovative, unique shots. And also this revealing of like what is left behind, right? So you see this pile of blood and like disintegrated body, right? And so it just looks like a puddle of that, and then it's wiped away to reveal Walt's face. So what we're seeing is like what's behind this mess, right? So I mean, it's a not so subtle way of like this is his responsibility right from the outset. It's a great shot. And again, I think a lot about mirrors in this series and reflection. And so we talked a little bit about mirroring in the previous episode. So we have the non-superimposable mirror images of chorality and Walt looking in the mirror and seeing himself. And again, this is through the looking glass in a way, right? Like quite literally through the looking glass.
Yeah. So what about you? What was your favorite line this week?
This was really hard to choose because there's some really
so many
great
of them in this one.
And more so than like a single line, like conversation. So what I kept being drawn to were the conversations that he was having with Gretchen. So we get that over the cold open, they slice together this flashback to their college days, and they're talking about what makes up a human being. And then he's cleaning up the mess. And then again, at the end of the episode, after he's killed Crazy Eight and he's parked on the overpass, we get the rest of that flashback. And it was a couple lines there. So he says to her, after they've calculated everything, doesn't it seem like something's missing? And that's when she says, what about the soul? And he says, the soul. And he sort of says it dismissively, right? Like, the soul, what's that? And then he says, and this is, if I had to say my favorite line, it's this one. There's nothing but chemistry here. And of course, that's like a flirtatious reference to the chemistry between them.
It's kind of a Mac line, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it is.
As far as like what we see of him overall, as far as being like a player or something, like it's non-existent. But right here, he really does come with something pretty slick, I think.
Yeah, it's a great little pun. But I think it's interesting that he's thinking specifically about this moment. This is what he's remembering as he's scooping up Emilio's remains, and right after he's killed Crazy Eight, this is what he's thinking of. So like the idea that this is just chemistry is I think again speaks to how Walt is compartmentalizing, right? This is just business. It's just chemistry. So the bodies, right? Emilio and Crazy Eight are just the sum of their parts. It's just hydrogen, oxygen, calcium, iron, carbon, etc. And also like what he's doing is a means to an end. It's business. It's not personal. So I think that's, you know, this idea that it's nothing but chemistry is how he's rationalizing what he's doing.
Yeah, that's a great comparison, because that is the thing, right? It's business, it's not personal. Like that is the mantra that you have to adopt, not just in the drug game, but in business in general, right? So, but like here, it's a little bit more extreme, because yeah, sometimes people are going to get hurt as an explicit part of that business, and in an extreme case, people are going to die because can't leave any witnesses behind or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. And then as far as my favorite shot comes towards the end. So it's right after he's discovered the missing shard of plate and, you know, the no, why are you doing this? Why are you doing this? And then we see him. The shot is from like the bottom of the stairs looking up in the basement to where the door opens, and we just see his silhouette.
Like a horror movie shot almost.
Yeah, so we just get this shot of his silhouette. So he's this darkened figure in the doorway. And it is like a horror film, right? And then like they do some really interesting camera work to, of course, increase the tension. We get the close-ups on his face as he moves down. But that particular shot, you know it's coming. You know that there's like a shift there. And it's a descent into darkness, literally. So he's descending down into the basement. And of course, when we think of basements in horror films, right, nothing good ever happens in a basement. So like, you know, that's where Clarice Starling in Silence of the Lambs encounters Buffalo Bill, right? That's where the monsters and the ghouls and so on and so forth live. But it's also like a descent into the subconscious or the shadow self, if you wanted to get like a little Jungian up in here, right? So like this idea of going into the darkest recesses of yourself, and he is, right? So he's literally descending into a darkened space. It's nighttime. So normally in the shots earlier in the episode, there's that little window where the stairs turn and you get the sunlight streaming in, but it's complete dark. You only have like the artificial overhead lighting in the basement. So there's this descent in darkness, this confrontation with the shadow self. And of course, we know the missing
blood is still there. You know what I mean? Yeah. That from when Emilio was leaking through the floor.
Yeah. And so that missing shard, that, and I said when I was giving my impressions of this episode, if I had to classify this episode or describe this episode in a single sentence, something's missing. It's the missing shard, but it's also the piece that is now missing in Walt when he takes Crazy Eight's life.
And you know, the whole discovery of that, the watching him go through that, it's a betrayal, right?
Yeah.
And that's the sense that he's feeling. And that's something that can move you to, that's an emotion that can move you to retaliate, or you know, like if you think about like how he has to get there, you know, like we're talking about this piece that's missing after he's gone, and where, you know, how he gets to the point where that disappears. They became friends almost, right? You know, mm-hmm. you have that great thing where they're talking about the, you know, they're singing the jingle of the furniture.
Yeah,
you know, and they really connect in a way over this idea that he tells him something that he can't tell anybody else, anybody who's really close to him in his life, right? And then that when he sees that piece, it's an actual betrayal at that point. This is someone that he thought he knew, he, you know, in that moment. This is someone that he was about to let go because he felt like Crazy Eight did his job, right? He gave him enough to that he could just say, okay, I think this is going to work out, right? Mm-hmm. Even though that's ridiculous, as we've said several times in this episode, he did what he needed to do on a human level between two people to make it seem like it might be all right.
Yeah, yeah. And it's all the more interesting, though, after getting to really know him is when he decides to finally go forward and actually kill him. And the nature of that conversation that they have is all about family, right? So they're talking about, you know, his father, and you get the sense that Crazy Eight, or Domingo, his real name, he comes from a very average middle-class American family trying to live the American dream. Like, they have their own little store, their furniture store. Mm-hmm. He gets to know about, like, his dreams and his hopes. He wanted to be a musician. Some of that tension with his father, right? It's so mm-hmm. it's so personal, and it's such an intimate moment, and this exchange of them talking. I mentioned this to you the other day when we were talking off camera, but it is something that I keep coming back to, and this idea of like this confession before death, right? Or like last rites almost sort of thing. So this exchange, this very personal exchange right before this horrific act of murder happens, I think is really, it's something I'm still teasing out and considering. I think there's a lot more to say about it, certainly as we go forward, and thinking about Walt and his evolution, or probably devolution is the better word, his transformation, his decay.
Yeah, so his transformation. Yeah. I just do want to say for sure that the position of this podcast is that murder is wrong. And we say that with an exclamation point at the end of it.
Yeah, as we see on his list that he's making as he's sitting on a toilet. And one other thing we haven't talked about is like how prominently the toilet figures in this episode, right? And like the series in general. So, but yes, he's on the toilet as he's making this list. And I wanted to just go over like the points that he makes on his reasons to let Crazy Eight live. So he starts he starts with off, first of all, it's the moral thing to do, right? And that's like the most rational, like, you know, like that should be the first point. It's the right thing to do, right? Like you let him live because that's what you do. And then the next point he makes is Judeo-Christian principles. Now, I don't get the sense that Walt is particularly religious or that's something that plays a big part in his life or something that, you know.
It's certainly never emphasized anywhere else in the series. It jumps out at you when you look at it. Like, wait, where did that come from?
Yeah, and I just wanted to point that one out because I do feel like that is an important part of the episode in understanding this discussion of the soul and what's missing. And we've already talked a lot about like what the piece is missing, the shard, and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. Plate is yellow. Walt happens to be wearing a yellow shirt that's almost the same color as the plate at the end of the episode when he kills Crazy Eight. And then, of course, we get the line from Gretchen, what about the soul? And Walt kind of laughs that line off like, the soul, it's just chemistry. Of course he's being flirtatious, but you can read into that a little bit more. And then
it's also an implication that he doesn't believe in such non-scientific things, right?
Yeah. And that the next point he makes on his list is you are not a murderer, not being underlined. Yeah. Sanctity of life. He may listen to reason, but of course, you know, I feel like he could probably scratch that one out based on the conversation he had with Jesse, you know, in the previous episode. He's like, what do you think, you know, he's a businessman. Do you think he's capable of listening to reason? And, you know, Jesse
well,
has
there's
the
that.
Great, yeah.
You try to kill us. There's that.
Yeah. So there's that great comeback there. And then what I really wanted to get to, though, are like the next like 3 points that I think are really, really interesting in terms of like how we're going to see Walt evolve. So he thinks he might get post-traumatic stress as a result of this. And then so he has that as a point. And then the next point is you won't be able to live with yourself. And then the last point is murder is wrong, exclamation mark. And those other 2 points, the idea of PTSD or post-traumatic stress and then not being able to live with himself, are things that we learn he absolutely can live with himself, right? Like he realizes that it's something that he's able to get on with, and he doesn't suffer from any post-traumatic stress. At least I don't think he does. Not in the traditional sense.
Yeah, not in the sense where it incapacitates him or he can't move on. He actually picks up momentum as he goes, right? I mean, the show obviously does in the way that it's put together, but I think if he does have something like that going on, if he does have that kind of remorse or that he just redirects it in a way that is completely unhealthy and just sort of maybe like shoves it down and tries to keep moving or you know whatever, something like that.
Yeah, and to loop back to a point you made earlier in the podcast, Pete, when you were talking about like this idea of like, have you ever been caught in a lie? Sometimes people double down, right? And I think in this case, he is doubling down, right? So it's like, I've already gone this far. I'm going to go further. And, you know, so that might be how he copes with it. It's like, it doesn't really matter beyond this point, or you learn that you can live with yourself. And again,
there is a rationality to that, right? I mean, it's not necessarily correct, but it's rational in a way. If you're already going to go to prison for life anyways, or you're already going to die from cancer, why not?
Yeah. And this idea that you won't be able to live with yourself, I think, is one that is explored throughout the series, and how different characters are faced with the stress, yeah. Right? So we certainly see like what happens with Jesse when he has to kill Gail, but also that's a line that's picked up again quite often in Better Call Saul. So we see there's a really great exchange between Mike and Jimmy, like, how can you live with yourself? How do you keep going on? Do you remember that when they're yeah. talking in the car? And then Jimmy tries to parrot that conversation back to Kim later. So it's something that I think figures prominently in this universe, in this world. Like, how do you live with yourself? How do you continue after doing these horrible things? And I think it's a question that Vince Gilligan et al. are continually asking of the characters and asking us as viewers to consider.
How do they, and then what does that mean? And there's just one other thing that, when you were talking about Better Call Saul there, one of the things that we talked about again off, but when we were planning this episode, was the fact that that's the thing that Howard says to Jimmy and Kim whenever he finally calls them out for their chicanery, right? He says, you're missing a piece. There's something wrong with you. You're missing a piece. And I never thought about that connection to this episode until we were watching it this time. So I think that's a pretty good place to wrap this episode up this week.
Something is missing.
Yeah, something is definitely missing. It's a thing in the world of Vince Gilligan created television shows, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
So if you enjoyed this episode, we really appreciate it if you would rate and review us wherever you listen to podcasts. That would help us out quite a bit. We're trying to get going here. It's a brand new podcast. It's a new thing for us. And any help would be much appreciated.
Yeah, connect with us on Twitter at BreakingBadGDT, and you can write to us at BreakingBadGDT@gmail.com.
And that's GDT as in growth, decay, transformation.
And you can find producer Talitha's Instagram at Talitha_makes_things.
Thanks for doing this again with me, Courtney. It's always a pleasure.
Likewise.
And we'll talk to you guys next week.